This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Lieutenant Governor Josh Green is back in Honolulu following a whirlwind mass vaccination trip to Samoa, where measles has now claimed 70 lives. There is also now a small outbreak of the disease in American Samoa. Green joined us earlier this morning to talk about his trip and what happens next.
Well, it was life-changing because, number one, so many people in Hawaii stepped up immediately without any hesitation to help people somewhere far away. And we didn't expect to have 500 people volunteer within 24 hours. That was shocking. We knew Aloha was strong, but we didn't know it could be this fast, is what we're saying and seeing. The takeaways were many on the ground, which I can share. It was both heartbreaking and heartlifting. We got there because the Samoan government decided they were going to do a moonshot, which was try to immunize their entire country in 48 hours. They had a very low immunization rate, which meant that when the measles outbreak hit, it was just crushing to the whole country. So the prime minister reached out. I had some relationship with the World Health Organization and with the CDC. And then Mayor Hahnemann Amufi connected me to the top leadership when he knew that I wanted to weigh in with our medical corps. So everything came together, and before you knew it, incredible generosity. Hawaiian Airlines donated a full plane for us to go over. We had 76 members of the team. We had the donation of 76 seats to come back on Fiji Airways, Queens, Hawaii Pacific Health, Healthcare Association, PAR Hawaii, incredible AirMed. I mean, all these guys just volunteered to give resources and get us over there. Meanwhile, the volunteers themselves just set their lives aside to go and try to make sure that we didn't see any children die.
And this was really kind of commando style. You just jumped in. And then now, did you leave any personnel there? Is there anybody still there from Hawaii?
Yes, we did. So we flew out with this large medical team, and two of our physicians from Hawaii Pacific Health stayed behind to help man the hospital. They're pediatric intensivists. That's what we need, because most of the terrible cases that remain were children who end up getting the measles and then having severe pneumonias. And there's a terrible pneumonia going around with people who are immune compromised in Samoa. So those guys are fantastic. God bless them. And we also are sending back some people. We're sending, for instance, back a biomed technician, because we took a lot of machinery and donated it from the Healthcare Association and the hospitals I mentioned. For instance, ER machinery, respiratory supplies, medications. But some of them are pretty technical, and so we have a biomed person going back. And we're going to continue to send people as they need instantly again. Hawaiian Airlines and Fiji Airways gave free tickets. I mean, it's just amazing, the generosity of spirit. And I think Hawaii is going to benefit from that, because in a number of ways. One is there was a sense of aloha going outward to the Pacific. Two, people across all of the Pacific, like New Zealand, Australia, Samoa, American Samoa, realize that we care deeply about the region. And honestly, people didn't know that you could mobilize that fast. And it helps them and it helps us, because we didn't spend any of our taxpayer dollars, but it benefits Hawaii, because if an epidemic like this gets worse and spreads, it could actually hit Hawaii, because we're not fully immune either.
I was able to hear an interview that was done with New Zealand media, and there was some concern because there were a lot of the anti-vaxxer folks pushing out social media while you were there.
Yeah, we didn't experience that in the field. Not a single person rejected immunizations, not one that I came across, and I went all over the country. It is disconcerting because, though I believe in free will and people should make decisions, I'm a strong believer in immunizations. We walked into a small village where a grandfather pointed at another house and asked us to run there. Dr. Tensala and I, Nadine, who's our pediatrician on the team, and I got into that house, and the baby was hot from fever, we thought, and in a moment we realized that she had already passed away. So when someone who's an anti-vaxxer says don't vaccinate, I want them to go there and see what it's like to have a dead baby, you know, in the arms of the mother and six other siblings around that could die from the measles. You go there and experience that, and then tell me that a vaccination isn't necessary. So again, I respect people's belief systems, and some people just can't get there. But, you know, if there are people who are unvaccinated and they get the measles, no newborns are safe. Any newborn can't get a vaccination till at least 6 months. They'll be subject to the same kind of risk of a measles outbreak or mumps or rubella. They can end up deaf. They can end up with neurologic damage, brain damage. They can end up dead. So vaccinations are something that have to be done. And I said it in a couple interviews, I don't think it's going to be an act of terrorism that threatens humanity in the next 100 years. I think it's going to be a vast outbreak of disease if we're not careful. That would definitely take more people down.
And the situation in Samoa happened because of, I guess, a bad mix of vaccines initially, right?
Right. Just a tragic accident. A pair of nurses were just made a mistake, and they drew up the wrong solvent. And so they put a muscle relaxant into a vaccination. And then, unfortunately, in their panic, they tried to cover it up. And so, you know, they're suffering the consequences legally and in prison for that. But when that happened about 18 months ago, the confidence in vaccinations dropped, and it was just human error. And then, you know, people just made a terrible mistake to try to cover it up. Instead, we should be transparent and do things right. We should follow the right science, do things right. But look, there's mistakes and errors in every discipline, healthcare related. Docs make plenty of mistakes. Nurses can. We all can. But the result of that was lack of confidence. The immunization rates got down into the 30 percentile, and then the wave of the epidemic. So we now got them up from 30% to 90% in about 20 days. The biggest push being, of course, when the Prime Minister had us come out as the American team to partner with them, and we did 33,997 immunizations in 2 days.
Wow.
It was a big one.
And then what about the infants? What about those under 6 months of age?
So right now, it's 6 months to 60 years old is who we're immunizing. Everybody will get some passive immunity now that we're over 90%, which is also called herd immunity, which is good. The Samoan government has now recommitted itself to public health, so they will be ready to immunize everybody as soon as they're eligible. And they're going to be extremely cautious because, one, the benefit of all the extended family now being immune, they won't get measles, so then the infants won't be exposed to measles. But there will be some cases. There are going to certainly be more cases of measles in Samoa and American Samoa than there are in other parts of the developed world. It's one of the dangerous risks of having very few people immunized, because then all infants are subjected, and you can bet that there will be a high fatality rate. 2% of all the people that were infected by measles are dying right now over in Samoa. So by immunizing upwards of 40,000 people fast, we believe we prevented at least 600 deaths.
And so is there anything that we need to be doing here in Hawaii to reach out to the Samoan community?
There are lots of things we can do. People who want to support this mission should reach out to the Healthcare Association. Everyone was so generous, but they could support that way. Everyone should be immunized, certainly if they're going to travel to any of these areas. No one should travel to Samoa or American Samoa unless they're fully immunized. They should have their immunizations and a booster, and probably even a titer to make sure that their immunity is rock solid. But there's lots of ways. Donate your time here, too. We want to make sure that everyone's immunized here that doesn't reject it for some personal reason. And once again, I'll say I hope everyone will get immunized, not because I'm a zealot on the matter, just because I'm a doctor and I've seen fatalities and heartbreak. You don't have to buy into some special ideology to get vaccinated. We're talking about protecting the very young and the very old for the most part, but everyone should get vaccinated, because otherwise, if you get the disease, it will spread. You may survive, but people who are more vulnerable won't. And that's not a way in society that we can live. In society, we've made a commitment to intermingle, to share resources, to share the roads, share the hospitals, share our public schools. So if we're going to be together, we're kind of honor-bound to make sure we don't hurt one another. And we do hurt one another if we don't have adequate immunization.
Okay. Well, Lieutenant Governor, thank you so much for your time.
It's been an honor.
We were hearing from Lieutenant Governor Josh Green, who just took part in a mass immunization program in Samoa, where 70 people, mostly children, have died from the disease, from the measles. Green tells us he's been talking to the Surgeon General about the effort to help our Pacific neighbors, and who hopes to visit the area soon.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Maui Chamber Orchestra and Chorus, celebrating the season with music of Mozart and Bach and classic carols, December 21st and 22nd at the Iao Theater. Tickets at mauichamberorchestra.org.
You know, a few months ago, the University of Hawaii shut down its Confucius Center. It's a program that was started to promote Chinese language and culture. Scores of other universities shut down similar centers amid talk of espionage and potential loss of federal funding. Also this spring, UH was identified as one of 27 schools targeted by Chinese hackers trying to steal maritime technology research. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Hawaii wouldn't talk specifically about any links between those events and what's been dubbed the China Initiative. The Justice Department started it a year and a half ago to guard against the theft of U.S. intellectual property. Just this past week, John Demers, the Assistant U.S. Attorney for National Security with the Justice Department, flew here to Honolulu from our nation's capital. He met with members of the Hawaii Chamber of Commerce and Academia to talk about the China Initiative. Over the last year and a half, the administration has indicted a string of people, including former Intelligence and Defense Department officials, as well as university researchers, engineers, Chinese nationals, and even a U.S. naval officer linked to sharing secrets. Demers cautioned about China's 3R strategy: rob, replicate, and replace.
So I'm here to reach out to the business community in particular, but also the university academic community, to talk about the threat to their intellectual property posed by the Chinese government. So to talk about our espionage cases, to talk about the Justice Department's China Initiative, which is a program we put together about 14 months ago to fight back against Chinese thefts of intellectual property.
So how bad is the problem?
It's a very serious problem. It's very well resourced. It's very top down. It is just one of the routine methods that they are using to develop technologically. They do it in some very legitimate ways as well, with traditional investments and research and development. But there's an aspect of it which involves stealing technology from U.S. companies, from European companies, and then using that technology to replicate those products in China and then replace that company on the Chinese market, and if all goes well, on the domestic market. So it's a rob, replicate, and replace approach to economic development.
And you had mentioned before that it used to be that they would cast a wide net, but they're a lot more strategic at this point.
Mm-hmm. It's very sophisticated. So they start with their Made in China 2025 plan, which outlines the 10 areas from agriculture to jet planes that they want to be world leaders in terms of domestic production capability. And as they work through this and as they figure out what it is that they need in order to develop that technological leadership, they're very specific about the kind of information and intellectual property that they're stealing. So a number of our cases last year involved commercial jet engines, and that's part of their plan to build a competitor in the jet engine market globally. On the intellectual property side, the areas really run the gamut. So we have seen, as I said, commercial jet engines. We've seen computer memory chips. We've seen interest even in the BPA-free lining of water bottles, right? We've seen interest in agricultural products, whether they're seeds, genetically modified seeds, or proprietary software that helps farmers decide what nutrients to apply to the soil. So we see a wide variety of areas, interests in the Chinese, both obviously to feed their people is one aspect of that, but also to develop technologically.
And as far as what business executives, IT people, security people need to be alert to, maybe something that might seem innocuous is something more sinister?
Yeah, so most of the cases we charge these days involve insiders, employees of companies who've been co-opted by Chinese intelligence services or been convinced through the Chinese Thousand Talents program to collect intellectual property from their employers and then transfer that to China. So to the business community, that means that you have to be aware of suspicious behaviors. That is, people who are trying to access data or access physical parts of the company where they have no business being, people when they're about to leave the company who are downloading a lot of data or sending it to their home computer. And in order to do that, you have to have those mechanisms set up ahead of time that guard your IT systems, that flag for you when there's some suspicious behavior. And you have to look at the physical security as well, depending on the type of company you are.
And so who do they turn to? Who do they reach out to if they have, you know, some suspicion that something is not right?
Reach out to your local FBI office. Reach out to the local U.S. Attorney's office. But develop those relationships before you see something that's not right. It's much easier to pick up the phone and call someone when you've already met them and you didn't need anything or you weren't worried about it. It's much harder in a moment of crisis to know who to call and how to get in touch with them if you've never talked to them before. Also, the FBI can provide businesses with intel that the FBI is seeing that can better sort of tailor the threat to that particular business. So they may be able to tell them whether there was specific intelligence targeting that business or that business line of products, and help them, you know, also work through some of the programs, the security programs that they would have, and have recommendations for best practices.
You talked about sometimes the Chinese companies will jump on LinkedIn as a way to be able to reach out or identify people that might be useful to them. What are you telling businesses and academia at this point? Mm-hmm.
So Chinese intelligence officers will use LinkedIn, other social media to reach out to U.S. people at companies in academia who are doing research or working for companies in areas of interest to them. And the ultimate goal is to convince them to travel to China and then to co-opt them at that point to usually in exchange for money to give them the intellectual property that they're looking for. So the thing to look out for here obviously is travel patterns, and also just letting your folks in the office know that, you know, you may think that you don't have anything of interest at this company, but you may well be a target of Chinese intelligence collection, even if you're not doing classified work or you're not doing export controlled work at your company.
Are there any signs, I guess, that maybe business executives need to be alert to?
The biggest ones we see are people being in places, either physically or on the IT systems, that they don't need to be. That's the biggest sign that we see in terms of behavior. People, you know, traveling all of a sudden to China where they hadn't traveled before, maybe they don't have any family in China or something like, you know, obviously some of that could just be tourism and a love for the culture and history of China, but there could be something else going on there as well. On the university side, we distinguish between two types of intellectual property because universities are meant to be open places with a lot more sharing going on than, say, a company is. So what we'll say is if, obviously, you're doing classified research or you're doing export-controlled research or research that's funded by the government, you know, you have an obligation, obviously, to protect that data. If it's about your own research, what we say to the university is you need to figure out what it is that you want to protect. And so we're going to educate you about what it is the Chinese are interested in so you can make informed decisions about this. But you need to figure out what it is you want to protect. And what I say is, you know, what you have to ensure is transparency among your professors. Schools need to make informed decisions about where the money is coming from to fund various labs or to fund different programs on their campus. They have to ensure that there's always academic freedom, that is, that it's the school and not the funders that's determining who's teaching and what they're teaching. But also that when you have a visitor, or a visiting professor, say, a visiting researcher coming to campus, and they've gotten a visa to study a particular topic in a particular lab and professor, and that would all be above board, you have to make sure that you know that that's what that person is doing once they arrive. Because we have many cases that we see where, although the person was legitimately granted a visa, once they got here, they started doing work in a different lab, even in one case at a different school. So that's something that schools have to keep an eye on.
And you're here focused on China because it's the China Initiative, but what about other countries, you know, Russia or someone else that might be looking to co-opt something?
Right. So 80% of our economic espionage cases involve China. So China is the number one player in this area. We do see the Russians interested in export control technology, weapons, night vision goggles, things like that. And that is something also for you to keep an eye out for. The good thing is if you're focused on behaviors, it really doesn't matter where the threat is coming from because what you'll see is the suspicious behavior, and then you can react to that behavior you're not focused on who the actors are. You're focused on what the behavior at the company that you're seeing is. Hawaii is so strategically important to the U.S., given its location in the Pacific, that you are of great interest to the Chinese government on the political espionage side in particular, but also on the economic espionage side. And it's just something that, you know, you have to approach with your eyes wide open if you're doing business in Hawaii or you're running a university in Hawaii.
And if you are somebody, let's say, who gets a cold call and a contact to do some business and to connect with Chinese companies, any advice to them?
Well, don't call them back, number one. And number two, you know, consider whether you want to report that or not, either to your employer, and then, you know, with the employer, you could decide whether you want to report it to law enforcement.
That was John Demers with the Justice Department. He met with business and university leaders last week to warn about increasing efforts by China to steal trade secrets. For links to find out more, head to our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. You know, this summer here on The Conversation, we brought you stories about a bird relocation effort on Maui. Sadly, the honey creepers, the QBQ, fell victim to mosquitoes. That's the focus of our reality check with Civil Beat reporter Nathan Eagle. Good morning.
Good morning.
You know, I have to admit, birds are not on my favorite creature list, not high up there. But, you know, I was looking at those photos on your website. Oh, my gosh. Those are just heartbreaking.
It really is. And I confess they kind of grew on me, too, over the years, first with that trip out to the Northwesterns with seabirds, and then more recently after spending 10 days in the woods with these researchers out on Maui. You can't help but be affected by them. But, yeah, seeing them, you know, at that stage when we were on the windward side, alive and full of life and everyone's hopeful, we're going to translocate these and bring them to this other side to hopefully establish this second population. Then to learn now that all but one of them have died from avian malaria transmitted by mosquitoes, it's just heartbreaking.
Yes, and Hannah Mounds was so full of hope earlier this summer. So it was pretty devastating, I think, to have this happen. But I guess it just underscores that, you know, we're kind of running out of time here. There's a sense of urgency.
Absolutely. And they've been saying even those words, though, for years, that it's kind of like we need an urgency to our sense of urgency. I was looking, just doing some research on this before writing this story, and found reports dating back to the 1960s or even earlier with scientists saying, hey, guys, like this avian malaria is making our native forest birds go extinct, and we really need to do something. And here we are, 2019, and a solution could still be years away.
Now, Hannah was talking about the concern that researchers have because, you know, there used to be a line, right? If you can get the birds up beyond this point away from the mosquitoes, that they had a decent shot at survival. But, you know, with these mosquitoes attacking these birds, you know, they're saying, okay, do we move up to 6,000 feet?
Absolutely. And that's the biggest question, right? And is why is that moving so fast? And all signs seem to indicate climate change is the culprit here. You know, we had a record hot summer, and they think it moved that mosquito line up higher than it had ever been. You know, before they moved those QVQ over, they had surveyed the area. They didn't find, you know, mosquitoes and things like that. But that one quick summer later, they think, wow, the mosquito line's even higher. And, of course, that's a huge problem for other islands, too. Maui, there's still a little bit of room for growth, I guess you could call it, because they've got 10,000, 11,000-foot mountain at Haleakala. But, you know, Kauai, Oahu, other places, there's really no room for the birds to go higher.
And so talk about this new technique to try and, sterilize the mosquitoes?
Yeah, it's a mosquito birth control, basically. The researchers here and working with scientists on the mainland have identified as the best hope, basically, to do something about the mosquitoes. So basically what they're doing now is collecting a bunch of mosquitoes here in Hawaii. They're sending them to scientists at Michigan State University. They're getting infected with this bacteria called Wolbachia, if I'm pronouncing it right. And then they send them back. And what happens when they release all of these male mosquitoes that are infected with this bacteria is that the offspring is then sterile, so it can crash the population of mosquitoes and hopefully bring the birds some relief.
I know we've tried to do that with fruit flies, bringing sterile fruit flies over to California to help with their issues. But yeah, mosquitoes, I was like, wow, they're so tiny.
Yeah, it's a really challenging one. And they're looking, of course, at like programs that are being used to help humans with Zika and dengue. And it's a different species of mosquito, but it's can be a similar technology. And so they're trying to take a page out of that playbook and deploy it for the bird's sake.
So do we have time to develop all this research?
For some species, maybe. For others, it's really getting tight. You know, they're saying 10, 15 years maybe for the QVQ, which best estimates are there's between 40-some and 300-some birds left in the entire world. So I think there's maybe 17 different species of forest birds here in Hawaii that are left, and almost all of them are approaching extinction.
Well, thanks so much for your story, and I'm jealous that you got to go out there.
Thanks.
All right, it was reporter Nathan Eagle with today's reality check from our online news partners. Check out HonoluluCivilBeat.org. American Postcards is the title of the latest concert in the Honolulu Chamber Music Series. We sat down with Takuma Ito, composer of Picture Brides, written around the stories of picture brides who immigrated to Hawaii from Japan and Okinawa. Take a listen. Ito was inspired by Barbara Kawakami's award-winning book, Picture Bride Stories. The Austin-based award-winning string quartet, Invoke, will perform the piece tonight at the University of Hawaii.
So this was originally commissioned by this group that's coming, Invoke. They're a really unusual group in that they're a string quartet, but they also play banjo and mandolin, and they also sing. So the problem that presents itself is that they don't have any repertoire to draw from. They don't have past composers who've written for this unique combination. So they decided to commission four composers initially, and I was lucky enough to be selected as one of those. And what we came up with as a theme to draw the four pieces together was that we realized we were all coming from very different backgrounds. One was from South Carolina, one was from Texas, California, and here I was based in Hawaii. So we all did some research into the places that we were based in, and I was really drawn to this history of the picture brides, the brides that came over to Hawaii from Japan and Okinawa, and they only had a picture of their future husbands to know who that person was going to be, and maybe a little anecdotes from relatives back in Japan, but really very naive and not really having an understanding of what they were getting themselves into when they were making the trip here.
And as you did a deep dive on the Picture Bride history that we have, mm-hmm. What was it that struck you about that period?
Yeah, it's just, you see these photos, and I'm a Japanese-American myself, first generation, so I have no personal ties to Picture Brides, but these photos just reminded me of the photo albums my grandparents used to have, and it's an American history, part of American history that really resonated with me in ways that other American history never has. So there's something very personal to it, at least resonated with me, even though I don't have any personal connection to this history. Luckily enough for me, when I was composing this piece in 2017, there was a book that just came out a year before by Barbara Kawakami. She's an author also from here, and she had just published this a book called Picture Bride Stories. She's been very busy collecting these stories since the 80s, I believe. She went back to school at UH and was doing some research on textile, and she was doing a lot of interviews of textiles in the plantations, and she started gathering these stories, and she didn't have enough room in her first book, so she ended up publishing it in this second one some 20, 30 years later. And yeah, it's a great collection of a number of picture brides that she interviewed in the 80s, 90s, and they lived a long life. So yeah, really fascinating his stories.
When did you reach out to her when you had this idea to, you know, to latch onto this?
Right. So I composed the piece without contacting her first. I had just read her book. I reached out to her publisher after I had a recording of the piece and just hoping to send it to her for her enjoyment. And luckily enough, she responded, and we had a nice conversation. But I hadn't contacted her since until I found out this group, Invoke, was coming back, coming to the Hawaii for the first time. And so I reached out to her when I heard the news and asked her if I could go through her photos that she's collected and present those at the concert as a slideshow so that people would be able to learn about these photos of these women and what they went through when they came to Hawaii.
So it's really going to be a fascinating audiovisual experience for the audience.
Yeah, it's going to be a very unusual concert experience, especially for something like the Honolulu Chamber Music Series, where usually it's just musicians playing on stage. But this one, you'll have the musicians there, of course, but a slideshow that you can watch along.
I can imagine if folks go to the concert, they might want to learn more and pick up the book and do
right.
a deeper dive if they haven't already.
Right. And she'll be there at the concert. So she's bringing her family and some friends. You can go say hi to her and ask her questions, too. I think a lot of people in Hawaii are very familiar with this story, but I wasn't familiar a few years ago when I was starting this piece. So, and most people, I think, have not seen actual photos that these people exchanged. So I think it'll be a very informative and educational experience as well as a fun cultural musical experience.
And is there any one favorite that you have of the pieces that you'll be playing that night?
Oh, it's one piece. It's one movement. It's just, it goes through, it doesn't go into too much detail about each bride. The thing about music, it can't be terribly specific. So, and the slideshow doesn't have a lot of words or text, so you won't be reading too much and trying to squint. But yeah, there's some fascinating stories about how one woman, I think, was just coming to Hawaii to retrieve someone, and she ended up staying and getting married. So she wasn't even technically a picture bride, I think. She was given a picture to perhaps retrieve a close family friend and ended up marrying that person. There's some sad stories of people coming and they were supposed to meet their husbands, but not having met, the husband never came. There's some slightly less sad stories of them having to wait at the immigration for a few days until the husband came. And the way these women tell it seems so matter of fact. So the life that they describe must have been so difficult in so many ways. But when they're talking about these stories in their 80s and 90s, it just seems so, this was that and this was that. And so you have to kind of look through, read between the lines in what they're saying.
So you've got this string quartet that plays with ukulele?
Yeah, so they usually don't play ukulele. They play banjo and mandolin. But for this piece, I didn't see how I could use a banjo and a mandolin for a piece about Hawaii. So I asked them if they would learn the ukulele, and they said, sure. So they learned a whole new instrument just for this piece. And I had to learn how to play the instrument myself, too, because I wasn't familiar with it. So, yeah.
That must have been fun.
Yeah, so I picked up the ukulele a little bit. And so I had to.
So it challenged you.
Yeah, it did challenge me. And I don't think there's too many pieces that include a string quartet and ukulele, and certainly not on the Honolulu Chamber Music Series. It might be the first time an ukulele is being played. So,
well, good for you for pushing the envelope.
Yeah, I hope so.
That was Takuma Ito, who composed A Picture by Postcards, a concert for the string quartet Invoke. It's part of the Honolulu Chamber Music Series, which takes place tonight at the UH Orvis Auditorium.